Thank you very much, Dave. This is my first Chalk Talk, so bear with me a little bit. I'm going to follow the model set by the two talks that I've heard so far, especially Sean. I'm going to steal your organization here. But I'm a magazine editor. I'm used to sort of sitting there and twiddling with my fingers a lot, so that the format's a little unfamiliar. So I hope this will work well. I love Chalk Talks. I love listening to them. It's just like getting up and doing one is something new. I called this talk Colliding Domains because, I mean, there are collisions between scientists and journalists. There are lots of nice intersections, but I'm trying to sort of model things and find patterns and learn from you guys and how to look at things. And I think the most important step to understanding between scientists and journalists and working together is for them to understand what goes on in the other domain and how it differs from their own ways of looking at the world and frames of reference. So I'm going to try this. One is physics or science in general. I'm going to go to then journalism. And then, following Sean's model, 1 + 2 = what? But I'd like to go a little further. There are not just, we don't act alone. There is a big context in which the interactions between 1 and 2 work. There are many other actors in the mix, and this, I think, is really important. And I'm going to do some quick models and ideas of visually representing what goes on here. Now, David set this up well by stating the canonical model of science communication, which is science media and public that media is a great big blob that stands between scientists and the public. And this is what, if things don't go well between here and there, you blame it on the blob. It's, you know, the media, which, you know, always amuses particularly those of us who work in print media. And we know that the rules of the domain of broadcasting, the rules of the world of print are completely different. So we actually think of ourselves as a separate world from television and so forth, and the rules are very different. But anyway, this is a simple enough model to start with, and I should introduce what I do and sort of where I come from on thinking about these. This is my magazine that I work for now, but I started off as a newspaper journalist, and I was trained in political science and economics and newspaper journalism. I did started out working as a newspaper journalist, covering government and politics and policy issues. Then I did graduate work in policy studies and economics. I worked as just a standard newspaper journalist. I met lots of presidential candidates. I got went to lots of press conferences, did all sorts of political coverage, and then sort of fell into science, having taken all the basic courses but not really pursued science. After I'd been in journalism for a few years, and I needed to find a more sane occupation than newspaper reporting, which makes you run around. It's for the young. You operate on very tight deadlines. You stay up very late at night. You drink tons and tons of coffee, and then you go to bars and drink a lot with everybody. And you wake up in the morning, and there's this paper, and you see whether you made any mistakes. And it's kind of killing me. But then I went to work for a university writing press releases and publication pieces for about scientific research. And that was kind of the most shocking experience, the most shocking change in my career, because I did show the article to my source and got a critique from the source. And I found that the source generally saw the story completely differently than I did. Not completely, but there were huge amounts of nuance depending upon what field I was in. There were great ranges of misunderstanding and potentials for misunderstanding, and I'd regarded myself as a highly accurate, very careful reporter, and I had no idea that it could be seen so differently from the source's perspective. So I ended up doing the university science editing and science writing for 6 years. And then American Scientist, the magazine, moved to North Carolina, where I was working. And then I've been doing this now for 13 years, yeah. And I've been editor for 11 years of the magazine. What we do at the magazine is we work specifically with scientists on preparing popular accounts of their work, or writing commentary about issues in science, or writing book reviews. And we have, again, had a lot of experience now in looking at this from the standpoint of the journalist, because we at the magazine are journalists, and understanding the author's perspective, because everything we do, we send back to the author. And again, we're continually surprised. I mean, even after you've done this for as long as I have, which is more than 20 years now, you can keep being surprised by how different science looks from the inside than it looks from the outside. So I try to explain a little bit of what seems to go on in these, in the canonical model and some other models I have. So let's look at domains here. I need some help in understanding yours, because it's what I'm here for. Partly. Okay. And then we'll say, this is journalism. And here are two domains, and we need to understand the rules and the frames of reference of each. So, look at the human angle. The motivations of the people involved in these two domains, their goals, sort of what they're looking after. Somebody throw out something for physics. What's a goal, a motivation for doing the work? I need help here.
Recognition.
Okay. I said human. This is a human.
I was going to say to continue. Oh, that's included.
Well, yeah, there's, you know, there's... Yeah, okay. Aside from the money, it must not just be the money and the recognition. Glory, fame, money, what else? Curiosity, okay. Okay, any?
Explain natural phenomena.
Explain natural, okay. Which is related. I'll just say, explain phenom here.
To have meaningful collaborations and interactions with other people.
Okay.
I think that part is often underemphasized, right? When I explain to high school students about physics, it's,
right.
It's a very, very social enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Education,
your own education, or the goal of education as a...
But I meant the latter.
All of this, okay.
No, the first may be covered under curiosity.
So anyway, the motivation is to teach, to teach, yeah. Okay.
Another, discover something new.
Discover. That's explained, well, discover. Well, discovering new things is, meh, ooh, yeah, a little.
I think it's just the joy of the day-to-day work.
Joy, have.
Enjoy work, and this is also like play.
Play, joy, play, it's
joy.
Okay. What did you say? I'm sorry.
It's going to be useful for something.
Oh. Useful product here.
This is for technology.
For having fun, I guess, so that you can have fun. Okay. Well. These motivations, many of them are shared, obviously, by a journalist. The journalist wants recognition. Of course, the journalist doesn't want recognition for your work. The journalist wants recognition for his or her own work, which comes in different forms. It comes in prizes. It comes in getting on the front page. It comes in your editor throwing you more assignments, giving you a raise. You go from a smaller newspaper to a bigger newspaper, whatever that is. Now, the basis for on which this recognition comes is not the coin of the realm, the what you're judged on is not the same thing, obviously, as
being bothered,
yeah,
a little bit by the dollar sign there, because I don't think that's what it's really about.
Well, okay, or not.
Yeah.
I mean, when we said tenure and promotion, it's security. Okay. Well, let's not be too mercenary here, but let's say recognition can take many forms. Yes. Okay. You have prizes and things that are non-monetary, et cetera. Okay. The curiosity is certainly shared by journalists. There's nobody in journalism who doesn't have very broad and deep curiosity, because that's what motivates and drives journalists to do what they do. Again, this curiosity can be not necessarily about what you're curious about. Obviously, a journalist is one of the common criticisms made of journalists is by scientists is that they arrive with the story already in their head. They have an idea. That's because their own curiosity may have driven them to that, to ask a particular question, which is going to be often a different question than you've asked. But you share curiosity, obviously. The question of discovery and explaining phenomenon, I mean, for a journalist, discovering is to discover a story or something that excites the journalist. And again, it's the same thing. They're curious, and they would like to discover, and they would like to explain. But the motivation for explaining is not necessarily teaching or the growth of knowledge as it would be for a scientist. The interest in explaining the phenomenon is to make a good story, is to make something that will be interesting to the readers. So the explanation is driven by reader interest. The social stuff, well, journalists are just as sort of social and clubby and party-minded as anybody. At the AAAS meeting every year, which is the biggest gathering of science journalists, there are huge social interactions and events for journalists, but they're not the same as your social interaction. But obviously, we all have social interests and work. As I mentioned, teaching, you don't go into journalism to teach. I don't know very many people who are motivated by the idea of that what they do is educational.
Isn't it really? I mean, they're informing the public.
Right. Informational.
That's a huge part of, I would have thought, of the journalist's job.
Right. Well, I was just going to distinguish exactly that. Inform. The goal of journalism is to inform, and often a journalist who is driven by curiosity is self-educating in order to inform the public. So if you get a chance, you dig into your story as deeply as you can and find out as much and then share as much as you can. In a writer's mindset, most journalists are careful to not try to be set up as educators. Say, this is not my role to be an educator. I am someone who informs so that everyone has is more enlightened I shouldn't use that word. So that the journalist informs public debate and responds to the informational needs of the reader. That's, they're a purveyor of information. That's the market that they deal in.
But what is exactly the distinction between that and educating?
Well,
the context?
Yeah, I'm spending time on this because it's very important. I think that that many science journalists do see themselves as educators in the sense that they really think that people are fairly ignorant about science and that they're driven not only by their own curiosity but by a shared interest with scientists in having people know more about science. But they would explicitly say, it's not my job to explain the laws of thermodynamics to the audience. The educational system is supposed to do that. I do it only as much as my story requires it. So
it's not, so journalists don't want to fill in the gaps of
Right.
High school curriculum.
Yes, yes, I think so. They have to say, I look at the story first, I look at the reader's immediate needs, what's news, a lot of stuff that should be, it's not my fault that they weren't educated well and don't understand the story. I do my best to, you know, it's just too much of a burden. That's to most journalists, I think, would say, take that position. Well, joy and fun, obviously, again, most journalists have a lot of fun doing it, but they get the joy from, not from spending a lot of time in front of the blackboard with a lot of Greek and a lot of numbers and so forth. It's just a different sort of joy. And the useful product technology, obviously, it's the same. We are all interested in doing useful product. It's just that your product is not my product. I may or may not think your product is useful, and but very often, much journalism is driven by the assumption that technology is of broad interest and is of use. And when you consider the reader's interests, the reader's interests are often economic, as in, what's in it for me? So the technology angle on anything will usually be very popular in the media. So the next kind of question about the two domains that I think is useful is sort of, who do you work for? And this time I'd like to start with the journalist. The journalist works for the readers, and that's the most common sort of thing that you'll be told by a journalist, or that it's important to understand when dealing with a journalist, because the journalist's job is to anticipate the reader's needs, and the economic equation is the readers pay for the product or read the advertising that goes into the journalistic product. The publisher actually pays the journalist on behalf of the readers. The readers are the ones, they're the consumers of the good in the economic sense, so they have to be satisfied. It seems really simplistic, except that the journalist always sets him or herself up in relation to the source as saying, I am the advocate for and the representative of the reader. And that's something that's sort of the first thing that a journalist will insist be respected by the source. So physicists work for, yeah, yeah.
I think the most difficult thing in writing is to try to figure out who the readers are. Mm-hmm. And how do the journalists figure that out? I mean, it's very, very difficult. You write a textbook, you know who the readers are.
Right.
You write
In most journalism contexts, that's been extensively studied. That is, a newspaper, demographic studies are being done continually. Mm-hmm. And frankly, if you really look at this as an economic equation, every publication has a target readership that they're writing for, and that means those are the people who buy the products of the advertisers that publication wants to get. So Scientific American, many of the changes that they've gone through have been driven by the fact that they went after a business audience.
Scientific American is specialized, but let's say the New York Times. Mm-hmm. The science articles in the New York Times read by businessmen or stockbrokers.
Yes, oh, absolutely. And the New York Times has a very highly developed idea of its audience and its demographic. And they have, for instance, they position themselves as a national paper and try to sell national advertising. So they don't put the local angle on things the way in all their editions and so forth. So it's, when you're writing, of course, if you were writing for a publication, that's one thing. I'm kind of talking about the situations in which the media person is kind of here dealing with the scientists. You can explain till you're blue in the face what you think is important for someone to know, but a journalist will always make some sort of judgment about what's important for that imagined reader to know.
It's always the case that, not in your magazine because you're the editor, but an editor of newspapers actually are able to judge the scientific interests and capabilities of their readers?
No, I wouldn't. I would say that's one of the worst. Yeah, no, I would say that it's a terrific guess. And if you're talking about a reporter here, the reporter's working for the readers, and also an editor who makes decisions about science coverage who's not a science editor and is not, you know, science is always fed through different levels of editorial decision making, and it competes with other topics, and those are not people making those decisions who have any real solid sense of the scientific interests of the audience. And I've never seen a demographic study that actually surveyed the scientific interests of, I've seen lots of demographics, how much money do you make, what kind of products do you buy? would you read, like to have more news about sports versus more news about science? That's as detailed as it gets. Yeah.
But do we know?
I'm sure you're going to get to this later, but I was wondering in terms of the readers. Obviously, the journalist has to make a decision about what needs to be explained to the reader and what is common knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I see some of these surveys, which indicate it's pretty appalling, what the level of scientific knowledge of the general public. So is this something which the journalists study, or is this the decision about what needs to be explained and what we just sort of talked about with that?
Well, there are a lot of sort of ground rules like sixth grade education that are used, and sixth grade education is the most common benchmark in newspaper, general newspaper journalism. You write for someone with a sixth grade education. So that means that really...
do you have to have passed it for seventh grade?
And I, you know, I've never seen formulas in TV news, but I think they set the bar lower.
The average person in the general public has a higher level of education than that.
Right.
Why is it coached at the sixth grade level?
Yeah. Well, I should say the New York Times, for instance, is going to be looking at people sort of assuming a high school full high school education for all its readership. I'm talking about. Let's see, the Associated Press or the Santa Barbara paper.
That's the fourth grade level.
and the whole idea is just, it's sort of to be fully inclusive. And I think, I don't know, Eberhard isn't here today, but he mentioned that explaining things to a 12-year-old is what when the APS gives seminars on talking to the public and writing for the public, and they always say go at the 12-year-old. I don't know where this comes from. It's roughly the same benchmark, but it's pretty much maybe, I don't know. It's what I was taught in school, but I can't remember the rationale. It's just, of course, yes, Sean.
I was just wondering if a lot was known about readers of the science section of papers versus other sections in terms of their demographics. Are they older, younger, male, female?
Yeah, there have been studies of science section readers, again, mostly with the same kind of question, what products do you buy so that we can find advertisers that would support this section? A lot, except that clearly what I've seen is just, you know, it's a higher educated, higher demographic, and that's what keeps science stories in the paper, is because, partly because there is thought to be an educated readership that is highly valued by advertisers. But that's about as good as it gets, I think. Anyway, physicists obviously don't work for the readers of the paper, except in the sense that they, if you consider them to be your public and that you're funded by the National Science Foundation or something, then I guess you could say that. But who the physicist works for, I assume, is university, industry, nobody, yourself.
No, it is the readership of the scholarly.
Right.
This is very much so.
Right. Okay.
The leadership.
So if we're talking just who's your audience, then yes. And this, of course, as all of you know probably, causes some conflicts in how you communicate, because you would like to communicate, or you would like to be quoted in such a way that your peers would, when they hear you, feel that you were intelligently expressing things, and yet you're talking to the 12-year-olds or you're filtered through the reporter's ears and whatever, and it doesn't come out the way you would like your peers to hear it. I think that's a universal comment about media interaction. So, then, okay, let's talk about Darwinism for a moment. The competition in your domain is based on what? I mean, how do you win and lose in the game that you play in physics? What's the nature of the competition?
It's not a zero-sum game. Everybody can win some level.
Not everybody.
This is exciting.
You should read that thing posted out on my Dubai Nobel Prize winner. He said that science is the one area of human activity in which very mediocre people can do quite well. And there's a lot of truth in that. Like in music or in the arts and literature, you have to be exceptionally gifted to rise to the top. Mm-hmm. But of course, in physics, to rise to the top, you have to be very gifted. But to succeed, you don't have to.
Mm-hmm. It's not a winner-take-all environment.
Right, it's not a winner-take-all. Yeah. It's a very social collaborative. Uh-huh.
But it's a well-supported field.
Yeah. Right. It's a very well-supported.
Unlike, say, opera singing.
Exactly. Right.
Okay.
What was the question?
The question is, in the nature of competition and what constitutes success, how do you win in your particular domain?
You want to make important discoveries or recognize?
Okay.
Well, one is what you do in the recognition, and the other is funding. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're related, but not the same.
So, I guess I was thinking of, on a very small scale, of things like getting published in a particularly prestigious journal, the Nobel Prize, there is our recognized rewards for, okay, prizes, publications.
Hope is almost here.
obviously, you know, dollars, your endowed chair or whatever it is, there's
also research.
And yes, for research and, yeah. Okay, so now, competition in journalism, what's rewarded is very simple things. I mean, you get the story first, you break a story. I mean, that's the big thing. I get there first, okay? And you... Okay, so maybe this is not so different. This is different. You turn it around very quickly, and it has a big impact. So in daily life, this is what your journalist is competing against everybody, and get the story first, get it fast, have impact. And to have impact, you have placement. Obviously, if you were a news show, it'd be the top of the news hour. If you're in a newspaper, it's the front page. This means it's competing with other stories, non-science stories, obviously. This is audience attention. This is going to be your editor's attention. This is going to be just sort of the speed with which you work. Now, all of these things drive a lot. The nature of this competition is what drives what a lot of scientists complain about, and that is how quickly people do stories, how they must do it right away, even if it's something that needs years to happen in physics, you know, have to do it now. The fact that things like anecdote, hype, tools that increase the emotive impact, controversy, conflict, all increase the impact of a story on the audience. Anything that increases emotive impact. In addition, a story that says something, says absolutely, this has happened, blows it up, makes it quite exciting, even if it's really a very highly nuanced development going on in science, that's going to increase your impact, your placement. If you do it fast, then you don't want to know about the small details. The nature of competition in an area where, you know, you have the internet driving the speed of communication, you have television, which is very instantaneous, everybody wants to do live reports, you have print journalists working very hard to write a definitive print account, but they're working on the same time scales as those other people, trying for all these things and competing in very clogged channels of communication.
Is there any reward for accuracy?
Then I was going to put it put in small letters down here. Yes, the motto in newspaper writing is, the basic motto is, get it first, comma, and get it right. And then the question of what's right is, you know, gets very complicated because there's a standard of rightness that I think some people would challenge. Yeah.
But is there any, aside from accuracy, is there any penalty for height? Put it differently, is there any memory? In other words, you can cure cancer every month on the front page, and 20 years later, you still haven't cured it. Does anybody?
Yeah. Now, we were talking on Friday that the penalty is public cynicism, but the journalist doesn't suffer from that as much as the source does. But they do suffer collectively. You know, there are lawsuits there, depending on what kind of story you're talking about. There is feedback from sources. That's the one of the things about science is it's so big that you can still always find somebody to talk to you, I think, you know, even after you've done. That's my sense, is that there are not very many fields where people can't still get sources and draw things from the literature and so forth, even if they're doing a really, really terrible job, because the community doesn't give them the feedback. If you're covering city hall government and you just keep screwing up, then the mayor will demand you be pulled off that beat, and, you know, and will publicly flagellate you, and you will have a penalty and your paper will do something about it. I don't know in science if that really works.
But David's question can be applied to physics as well. Is that height penalized? I mean, you know, ITC superconductivity was solved years and years ago by all kinds of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the answer is, there is no penalty. No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. The question
is still at Princeton.
Yeah. You need feedback mechanisms, but wait.
I think there's something missing from the left-hand side, which is that more and more now physicists, I think, get some of their competition from competing with their peers, as you can get their stories recognized by journalists.
Aha.
So, I mean, this is driven, I thought, by your last question. I think physicists, to some extent, are there for deans and vice chancellors and funding agencies who have funding offices who care whether the work that they support is recognized.
So is this also something that people compete for?
There are lots of pressures in that. There are lots of pressures in that direction. Those can be relatively healthy, and they can be pretty devastating.
Right.
Another interesting thing in this aspect is there are two journals which. It's not clear whether they fit into either of these. They're called Science and Nature.
Yeah.
And whether they're media or scientific journal is questionable. Somewhere in between. And they.
And that's a recent phenomenon, at least for other than the biological sciences. It's relatively recent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's been going a long, long time in medicine with the New England Journal and JAMA and so forth, but yeah.
To what extent do you look, let's say that there are two breakthrough stories. One is a very esoteric one. The other is, say, something that leads to pharmaceutical products and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So you as an editor who want to get as much advertising in your magazine as possible, look at these two and say, I print this one, and maybe this demonstrates a variation in Einstein's theory that's of interest to an awful lot of people. This one is a new discovery that pharmaceutical companies are going to take a very which in turn translates into advertising in your magazine. Mm-hmm. To what extent is there that kind of tilt?
Well, you have to break down the industry into some pieces because it tilts differently. There are magazines, let's say women's magazines, that are driven almost entirely by cosmetic and pharmaceutical advertising. They will go after anything that has, that's their advertiser base. They're perfectly open about it, you know, that they interact with the advertisers in that way. And they make a lot of money doing it. They try to maintain journalistic credibility by covering stories with high-quality writers and whatever, but they're still essentially in that game. And then there's the trade press. Most major newspapers, general audience newspapers, again, would be sort of, would claim to be offended by the question. The editors would say there is an absolute wall between business and editorial, and that's what our reputation rests on. Then there's the end run that they do around it, which is most editors will say, we look at our readers as essentially self-interested and as also investors in technology and so forth, and therefore we cover things that we think affect their pocketbooks. So then they will tend to do things that have economic, tend to write about things that have economic impact, and it's true that there is a lot of public interest in anything that will, or health, which is another self-interest question. And so those factors, both the Wall Street interest and the health interest that the public has, will go into feeding them. But I'm not sure that that's a clear distinction, really, in a lot of editors' minds, that there's not some pressure. I mean, nobody's that pure necessarily. You do know who your advertisers are. The old story is the local grocery store, you know. If they have E. coli turns up in your local grocery store's shelves, and the meat has to be recalled, how does that get covered by the local newspaper that gets 80% or more of its advertising dollar from the grocery store? You know, that raises a great deal of conflict, and the decisions are behind the scenes are often quite complex. Those things, yeah. Yes.
Okay, I'm curious, his motivation. Mm-hmm. It often happens that there is an announcement of a discovery which is greeted with a lot of skepticism. Mm-hmm. You know, most people don't believe it. But of course, the person who's announcing it is very enthusiastic.
Yeah.
Okay, so it seems to me that often gets a lot of press, mm-hmm. because of the, you know, possibility of a high impact and the rush to get it out first and all, mm-hmm. that.
Right.
Whereas, you know, 2 months later, it's completely discredited and everyone agrees it was all nonsense. And that gets maybe a slight retraction in the last page, or usually not mentioned at all.
Yeah.
So the public gets, you know, the impression that all of these things are happening, which turn out to be nothing.
Right.
They have no memory.
No, I do think that feeds public skepticism about science and system in general.
Is there any measure of that?
I'm trying to think of a good one. I brought along some data from the NSF and the Eurobarometer, and they're genetically modified organisms. There's been a great deal of study about changing public attitudes and how they've been influenced. Public attitudes towards GMO have been influenced by press coverage, and there has been a tremendous reduction in the general, in poll results when asked about the credibility of scientists and so forth in Europe. There's been a clear decline the last 3-4 years since the GMO debate worked out, and that's a real sense that scientists are sort of promoting breakthroughs and that there's back and forth going on, so
that's just the evil technology, Frankenfood.
Yeah. Yes, but
they blame
what?
Scientists for that.
Right.
They blame scientists
right.
for that.
Yeah,
right.
They have in the past as well. Yes. You know, when environmentalism began here, there was a big reaction against science, which by and large has disappeared from my judgment in the States. But I think that's more the evil Frankenstein destroying the environment, destroying the world.
Yes, but why are scientists not trusted as authorities? Not trusted to be the people making decisions on any of those fronts. I mean, there's
for good reason.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, but there is a clear erosion of the mystique of science going on there in a debate like that, and it's.
Well, the European press always finds some renegade scientists to denounce Frankenstein.
Yeah, well, then you have, you know, it's just one scientist against another, and people are like, you know, does anybody really know what they're saying here? Yeah. I was showing Sean just a few minutes before I came in here the press release from a company that makes tanning beds. Tanning beds just popped into my email box. Could tanning be good for you? Scientific research indicates avoiding UV light. Avoiding UV light may result in increased risk of cancer. So. And this is, says basically if you stay out of the sun too much, that there was a study published in the journal Cancer says that many people are avoiding the sun too much and they are at risk of higher cancer. It's because of basically vitamin D, that you're not taking your vitamin D. But anyway, and tanning beds, they actually put patients under tanning beds, and they got supposedly lower.
This must be preschoolers.
And then, yeah. Now, this is an interesting story because I'm going to be interested to see how it plays out in the media. It's clear Wolf System that makes the tanning beds is sending me the press release, and they made the mistake of putting their logo on, so it doesn't even look like it's a legitimate, you know, journal news release. But they've got some university people. I mean, it's Boston University and published the study and so forth and the whole thing. I think this kind of thing, which is clearly, I mean, they're motivated. They're going to make some money on their tanning beds. They're worried about losing money from people being scared about UV. It's just basic motivation, but this sort of thing actually will probably kick around in all kinds of sort of penny press kind of places, and who knows, women's magazines, places. And I think it increases skepticism about science, but that's, you know, that's just, you can see everybody's motivations at work. Everybody's doing their job. They're serving who they're paid for. And I don't think you can suppress a story like that either. So, you know, it's, okay, very quickly. This is a fascinating discussion for me. I really appreciate understanding how things look from elsewhere entirely. That's part of why I'm here. Now, looking at the culture of each of these, we've discussed the culture of the.
In regard to that, is there any motivation in the journalistic community to respond to something like that, to write something that contradicts it?
Oh, sure. They will call all the usual suspects who've already been quoted on studies about UV and skin cancer and so forth. They will take it apart. No one's going to. Well. I'd be surprised if this press release gets run in any form like it is, but we were going to get to the question of balance and fairness in a minute, and this is one of the things that I often comes up in these discussions. The balance and fairness are terms used a lot by journalists, and they're seen differently by, you know, within journalism, just by the training and the cultural practices of journalists. So balance and fairness are, let me just define this as a basic set of values for journalists. Now, I don't know if you would consider these to be cultural values within physics. You have a set of cultural values right now to kind of speed along a little.
There are always two sides to every story.
There you go. So fairness, this is a matter of training by journalists. When you are when you are working on a story, everybody coming out of journalism school sort of taking 101, what is fairness, okay? You have scientist A makes a claim, you go try to find scientist B of close to equal stature, or at least a scientist you can find to to tell you what scientist B thinks of scientist A's work. And if scientist B and scientist C, D, and E keep saying it's great, it's great, it's great, you keep going until you find scientist F who says, you know, no way, we have serious questions about this research. Now you have achieved fairness. Now, this, I mean, I've been covering science long enough that this doesn't hold up very well for me, but I understand. I've been, I did it myself a lot. I called and called until I got somebody who would give the other side of the story. So the assumption is that there is are more than one side to any story.
And then you can have people time or
something. Yeah.
No.
I actually, in my experience with science journalists, haven't found that at all. I found that people go around, they go to scientists A, B, C, D, and mm-hmm. B, who support the side of the story that they're basically working on, which is the one that, you know, new discovery,
yeah.
big impact.
Right.
And then they'll talk to a bunch of people who say negative things, but they'll print almost nothing about what those people mm. say.
Now, are these?
That seems to be more typical in yeah. the way, at least the science journalists.
Now, that's a science journalist. I really should distinguish between the way scientist journalists come to cover science, who are covering science all the time, and who don't take the kindergarten journalism 101 approach to things. I should have backed off pretty quickly from that. I mean, if you, this is the way people are taught and start off. It's a simplistic way of achieving balance and fairness to when you're taught in journalism. But most people I know have certainly given that up and developed enough understanding, perhaps if they cover science, of how science works, that this is not sort of the way you get to truth in science necessarily, is through this. Rather, yes, you try to have, most editors will say, we need at least three sources for everything. If you're going to state a fact, you got to find a couple more sources to support that, and three is kind of a magic number, and that means you've got A, B, and C, and if they're all lining up and you think you've done a good survey of fairly good, strong opinions in the field, then you're in pretty good shape. Where this kicks in is if there is any political or external kind of issue involved, let's say global warming. If you have a lot of political pressure that says, you know, or tobacco, I mean, I lived in North Carolina a long time, you had to get somebody from the Tobacco Institute to comment on the latest cancer study regarding lung disease, because that was the political environment that we lived in. We were not considered fair if you didn't let the Tobacco Institute say something. So global warming has taken on some of the same dimensions that the politics drive you to have to get somebody from, you know, the other side generally, unless you're a science journalist. Yeah.
So there's two ways that this can be annoying to a scientist. One is mm-hmm. if there's something very true and important that comes out and the journalist feels there's a need to have the crazy person say why it's wrong.
Yeah.
And there's the other thing where the crazy person says something first.
Yeah.
And the journalist talks to that person, gets very excited about the story. Maybe this is what Tom is worried about. And then the journalist keeps calling other people, all of whom say, oh no, that's probably not right, but the journalist just likes it so much that they have to go with the story anyway.
Yeah.
And I'm just being sympathetic. It's very hard for the journalist to really know,
right.
you know, who the crazy people are ahead of time. They don't say
something. Yeah. And call. You've got all that.
But we yeah. can tell you.
And you've got all.
Yeah.
You've got all.
I know, but it is.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing is as Sean says, By the time the story sort of starts to turn around in the case of an exciting new development by a crazy person, often the journalistic organization has committed, you know, they've left time in the news show, they've left a hole in the newspaper or something to do a story that maybe they shouldn't even be writing about. But as things move very, very quickly in media, and stories can get committed again that shouldn't be done, before the bubble starts to burst a little bit, or and a reporter who has a great front page story going has to have an enormous amount of sort of courage and sort of self-effacing potential and so forth to go dragging to the end. So that turns out to be a crazy person. you know, we really shouldn't be running this story. And many will, but it gets tough in there. Yeah.
I would say that because science intersects with society and therefore politics, balance and fairness are legitimate when you're talking about science story. But from the point of view of science, it seems to me balance and fairness are not identical at all. And that what you're talking about is balance. Fairness has no place, I would say. Now, obviously, since there are political implications, then these concepts do apply to the stories. But from the point of view of science, it seems to me what you were talking about was balance.
Yeah.
Fairness,
yeah.
Right.
Right, yeah. I agree. I mean, actually, in journalism, this whole concept of fairness has gotten to be kind of a bad word. It used to be there was objectivity, and then, you know, people said, no, objectivity is impossible. Everything is subjective judgment, so you should never use that term. Then what will we call it? Well, we're striving for fairness. And that's kind of gone, you know, it sort of dissolves in these simplistic models, and good newspapers don't kind of try to use these simple formulas. They do strive for balance. Yeah.
Your question of, you know, being called up by the crazy person.
Yeah.
Do science journalists have this sort of collection of establishment figures that they will check with, just sort of quickly check with?
A science journalist absolutely will have a huge Rolodex, but that, you know, I haven't seen any percentages, but if somebody sat down and looked at how much coverage of science was done by science journalists, if you surveyed the whole landscape of journalism right now, I don't know what percentage, it would be a very small percentage of the total science coverage. So it's mostly being done by people who don't have a huge Rolodex in a given field. You know, because it takes not only to do what you're talking about, it takes not only a good science journalist who's developed a network of contacts, but also someone in a particular field, say physics. You know, if you're wandering over and you've just done medical stories, who do you know? How do you know who to call?
How much do they rely on? I mean, they're intermediaries.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a troubled area. I mean, I was going to get around to it at the end of the talk, but. Sigma Xi, the Scientific Research Society, which publishes American Scientist, runs the Media Resource Service that used to be run by the Scientist Institute for Public Information. And it's a sort of screened list of experts in every field, and I think it's an extremely important thing. In the last few years, there's been such a demand for scientific experts that a number of other organizations have set up shop. And there's a fellow from Reuters was telling me a few days ago that there's a woman in New York who has three experts for every topic, that every scientific topic that pops up in one of these journal lists. This is what is in our journal Science or Nature this week. She will email a set of reporters three experts who she's paid to represent. She's a public relations consultant for whatever topic you have. And I looked at him, I said, do you use this? And he said, when I'm in a hurry, I do. I will call one. I mean, she's sending me the three names.
Who pays her, the journalist?
The journalist, well, what?
Who pays her?
The organizations, the universities and research institutes and other organizations.
So the scientists pay her that are, directly.
Yeah, I guess you would say so.
So,
and yeah, it's kind of like a book publicist, whatever, but you know, it's, she just, forget her name, I wrote down her name because I want to watch out for her, but she's good. Anyway, and then there are things like, there's a public relations, there's an organization that represents university news bureaus that you kind of pay, it's called ProfNet, you know, ProfNet. ProfNet is find a professor on any subject, and the university news bureaus get together their best efforts, or their best experts, and ProfNet sends out an email and says, we need an expert on such and such, and then all the university news bureaus throw in their experts. Well, I mean, that's better than nothing. The universities, to some extent, have screened, but it's sort of everybody for out to, you know, push their experts. And it tends to be used disproportionately by universities that are not in the top tier because they need the attention more. They're more motivated to use it. So there are systems, but, you know, it's not a great thing. I'm sorry, we are running out of time. I want to draw just a couple of pictures that are, when I tried to model this whole process, I ended up drawing my own goofy pictures, but I want to leave an impression in your mind. First of all, in the skipping very quickly to number four here, There's a nice model a fellow named John Durant at the Science Museum in London has put together that I think kind of summarizes the real world in which we live. And it's sort of like this. Here's the public, and here is the media. Between these two, there is a resonance that is what I've been trying to explain to some extent. It's in the 10th, the media are always listening. What are people interested in? What are they concerned about? Basically, because they pay the rent. And so, and also that's who you serve. It's your readers. Now, here, if you have basically political institutions, governments, policymakers, opinion leaders, you have public opinion which affects what they do, and then and you have a sensitivity here between the media and the political leaders. And then over here you have science. I mean, this is where scientists and other interest groups, you have advocacy groups, environmental groups, whatever. You have religion. And basically, you have sort of public relations efforts that kind of flow this way. You have public relations efforts that flow this way. And you have lobbying. I'm a social science major, so I tend to see things this way. But basically, I think there's very little interaction that goes on in this way without influence from all of these other actors. And all of that means simply that the coverage of science is continually, it's not a pure process at all, it's continually influenced by all these other actors, by sensitivity to the scientist's behavior in the process is also, of course, influenced by their sensitivity to all these other actors. And, you know, this isn't terribly helpful except that, and sorry, very messy, that I think that in any reporter's ears, if you were to sit for a day in the newspaper, the noise would come from all these sources, the noise that kind of influences the process. It's not necessarily that a journalist can ever kind of operate, you know, say, science, I'm going to write, just transmit what the scientist and what the scientific community is doing. Only some science journalists get the ability to do that. And the other two pictures, one picture that I quickly wanted to show you, aside from my, I did a bunch of economic modeling of how this works, but you're not interested in that. But if we just look at science, and supposedly, it works like this, right? I mean, okay. Yeah. Okay. And here we are at time such and such. Now, this is a sort of spongy kind of space here with holes in it, obviously, you know, that anybody's looking at when they're slicing this particular cone this way. Well, the other thing is that in a given, you know, area, sub-area, there will have been discoveries, there will be stuff that trails off, and there will be disputes, sort of bifurcations, shall we say. Now, a journalist basically kind of comes into this story and sees, you know, some tiny bit of the space. You got 2 hours to work on the story. You might see a hole here, you might see a path going this way. You don't know about all this stuff, and you don't know all this knowledge that it's built up on, which if you were writing a paper, you would try to stand on all these shoulders, cite all these things, give it all to do. I'm only begging for some understanding that this is all that you can see. and a scientist standing at this intersection point, talking to a journalist, needs to somehow convey the useful parts of this. And it's what the reason I like to work with people writing review articles and surveys of things is we try to find maybe 4,000 words that does the best we can to give you a view from this point maybe of a slice that's that big. But, you know, that's kind of incredibly ambitious. A journalist who digs any deeper than the surface layer is doing a kind of incredible job given the constraints that they're under. So I could give 3 more talks on the subject, but thanks a lot. On Friday, we're going to talk about writing books. If anybody would like to write books, we have a couple of people who've written books. The Friday workshops, I do invite everybody to come. They are for writers, people interested in communicating on any topic you'd like. You can suggest a topic, very informal. And Brian Green's going to come tell us some stories from writing, the experience of being an author this Friday. So thanks for coming.
I think we have time for some other questions.
Yeah, sure.
So one question I sometimes have when a reporter calls me up and starts asking me about assignments is what I can assume about the background of the reporter, mm-hmm. how much science knowledge the reporter has.
Yeah.
So do you advise us to think about them as 6th graders?
No. No, you would waste a lot of time. And one problem, we could have a lot of discussion about how to interact with reporters, and I'd like to in the workshops. But. You have to do everything very quickly because a reporter does not have much time. And trying to go through everything between 6th grade and the PhD is just not going to happen. In fact, it's counterproductive because too much information will get slices taken out of that in inappropriate ways and misinterpreted. So it's certainly a great idea to find out something about the background of the reporter. Have you written about this topic before? And if so, you know, what part of it do you know? An important thing is to encourage them to ask very elementary questions, because a smart reporter will always ask the stupid questions, and they will, but sometimes they need to feel comfortable with talking with you, a scientist, asking a stupid question or not even knowing how to phrase the question. So I think many reporters dealing with scientists will appreciate some help in refining the questions that they have in sort of simple but straightforward ways. And then you can tell from how they do that how much you can give them by way of information. A very hazardous thing, as many of you probably know by now, is to give the reporter too much information, kind of prattle on and assume any understanding of that will just turn into hash. I mean, it would with me if I were interviewing you and that's all you did. So.
Marty?
Yeah, mention your discussion, was focused on print media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I know.
But I was wondering if your feeling is that the importance of print media is changing, for instance, because of the internet.
Yeah.
And so
some of the statistics.
How are the rules changing?
Yeah. It just makes sort of things worse, I think. You know, everything in terms of time pressure and how much you can convey, the influence of both the internet and the and broadcast means that all these constraints are tighter. But I think I was looking at, I'm sorry, the Eurobarometer, I know it's European results, but they've done much better surveys of science information processing by the public than the US does, and they do line up with NSF statistics where we have them. But I think 60 to 65% of the public said they got their science news from broadcast media rather than print, and only I think 15% were from print media. So now, that changed with education level, and it means that the print media exposure was very highly biased toward higher education levels. People with higher education levels said they read mostly print. So you have a kind of you need to go maybe to 4th grade level when dealing with television, I don't know. the issues with TV are much more difficult because you have, you know, 30 seconds. It's hugely difficult.
One difference I've experienced between magazines and newspapers is that magazine reporters are perfectly willing and even desirous of showing you their product, passing royalty slates or this. And that invariably improves the story.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas newspaper journalists seem to regard this as something that would be unfair or or non-professional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to their detriment often, and it's not just time pressure, it's sort of a principle.
Yeah.
Seems.
Yeah, there is some change going on, certainly at science writing, at the annual workshops that where science writers get together, there's been a lot of discussion of what you show to your source. And Boyce Rensberger, who's now at MIT but used to be with the Washington Post, is a great advocate of showing things to scientists, which is not how newspaper reporters are trained. Because of the time pressure, because of the notion of being being independent, answerable to your readers and not to your sources, which are the sort of culture of the field things. But I have found all sorts of in-between positions. And in fact, online you can follow some threads and science writer discussions of this. And everybody's has their own rules, but if you probe them, and I encourage people to negotiate this, you can find that you can see a paragraph, you can have your quote read back to you, you can have lots of pieces of the story, as long as you don't offend a newspaper reporter by saying, well, I won't talk to you unless you will show me exactly what you're going to print entirely in advance. If you take that position, you're setting up a sort of adversarial position between whose story is it? It's my story, so I have the right to approve it, and an independent reporter will balk at that. But there are all sorts of in-between positions, which I think it's very important to ask about. So,
President, how much self-regulation goes on among journalists? Scientists are generally pretty good at that, in terms of sniffing out when it occurs, and if there's a really egregious case of scientific misconduct, it's generally dealt with pretty well. For example, you take the case of the labs a year ago, Chun, who published 40 papers that were wrong. And it was dealt with. Is there an equivalent in journalism where self-regulation of that kind occurs?
Well, no, it's slightly different. What happens is like Gina Colata, if you know Gina Colata, the New York Times, she's gotten beaten up a great deal by her colleagues. The way they've done it is they write about her, and they call up her sources and say, "What do you think of this story? And did she get it right?" And something like the Columbia Journalism Review, which is a publication explicitly set up to be self-critical, something like the Nation or Harper's or something will write a critique of media coverage of a particularly controversial issue. So there is open criticism of other publications by one. The other main thing is the ombudsman, which is being a lot discussed, particularly with the recent scandals at the New York Times. And the Washington Post has had an ombudsman for a long time. This is someone who acts as an advocate for any aggrieved source or outside party, whatever, and investigates issues that come up. And they publicly disclose them. That an ombudsman's typical agreement with the paper will be that this person does not answer to the editor, answers directly to the publisher, and when the ombudsman asks for space, the ombudsman gets it and lays everything out. This is controversial. You know, if you followed the New York Times, the Jason Blair incident, they spent 4 pages of the New York Times on going over that, and some people thought it was a little excessive, but do it. So, any other questions? Well, glad to
talk
anytime.